Hi everyone, thanks for joining us for this series of iDug podcasts where we speak to some great people in the DB2 community. I'm Marcus Davidge.
And I'm Julia Carter, and we represent the iDug content committee. We hope you enjoy today's edition.
It gives me great pleasure to welcome my colleague, Frank Rhodes. He's got the kind of name which feels like it should be Sir Frank Rhodes.
Oh, yeah, that's it.
He's a colleague of mine at BMC Software. Welcome to the iDug DB2 Table Talk podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's good to talk to you, Frank.
So we are live once again
at iDug.
iDug.
Yay!
The sun's going down, the view is beautiful from the Prague Congress Centre, looking over the old town. And we've had 2 days of great sessions. And so we thought we'd have a chat with my friend Frank.
We usually start by asking people how they got into DB2. And I think that your story is going to be quite an interesting one.
Okay.
So where did it start for you?
So in university, I interned at IBM.
Oh.
And IBM in Clear Lake, which was in support of the NASA systems. So I interned there, and I started out as a systems programmer. Well, working in the systems programmer group. You know, I was interning, was learning. And I did that, and then on subsequent interns, I actually went into shuttle flight software, navigation and control software.
Wow.
And I went through all of it.
Actual rocket science.
And when it was time to graduate, my thought was, who in their right mind would ever want to become a systems programmer? And by the time I graduated, I was like, you know what? I always wanted to do the shuttle stuff, but the systems programming, that was more fun. So I ended up taking the offer from them, and I was in support of the NASA administrative systems. You know, as a sysprog.
Yeah.
And my specialty was like kind of automated operations. So, you know, we talk about DB2. My knowledge of DB2 was how to start DB2 and stop DB2. That was my only experience when I joined BMC.
Oh, okay. And what version did you start with?
2.3 was the oldest when I got there. 3.1 was the active one.
Right. Okay. And what were you studying at university?
I studied aerospace engineering with computer science as my minor.
Wow.
I always wanted to do planes,
yeah.
And then I realized, okay, I can do the planes, but I have to work at it. The computer stuff just comes
naturally,
so I was like, that's probably a better choice.
And you were in Texas?
Yes.
And this is Texas A&M?
Yes. Texas A&M is when that's where I went to university, and that's where I did those internships.
So explain to our listeners what A&M stands for.
Agricultural and Mechanical University, which sounds, truthfully, it was a farming school.
Right.
You know, initially. That's where one of our songs are Farmers Fight, Farmers Fight, But it is now, it's a very large university. It's probably 60,000 students. So.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty big.
And then they have a number of different campuses throughout the state. It's kind of interesting because I live in Austin, and Austin, the main rival school is University of Texas. So I live where the University of Texas is.
Yeah. But you're an Aggie at heart.
An Aggie at heart.
And did lots of people feed from your university into NASA?
I only was aware of like two others. There was a number of people that, you know, did it from Purdue that came down, and a couple of other universities. Intern wise, it was about three of us.
Right.
But as I said, it was interesting. Like, what I always wanted to do shuttle stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember when I did my first internship, my manager was very nice because I told him, I go, look, I really want to do shuttle stuff. So he set me up so that I'd go back to school for a semester when I came back in a group doing navigation and control.
Right.
So when I went to go do that type of stuff, I was, it was still ISPF based, because what we would do is the shuttle software was, run on what we'd call a feed unit. So you'd have the shuttle computer running there, and the mainframe was sending in all the inputs as if it was flying. And then the computer would then do the calculations, figure out, and we would be verifying it. It's like, is there a software glitch? Is there some problem? Because I remember on one of our test runs, we did it, and it's like, oh, it looks like everything worked perfectly. Take a look at the altitude. Oh, it says the shuttle's at minus 200 feet. it's like, yeah, so something went wrong there. But that was the type of, we were doing analysis work related to that, doing those feed runs.
Wow. Cool. That's so exciting.
So this was DB2 2.3.
2.3 is when I got involved in 95. What I'm talking about, my experiences at NASA, was more like 87 to 95.
Okay.
Okay. So then after NASA, you decided to move on.
The systems that I supported were being moved from Houston to Huntsville, Alabama, and we didn't really want to relocate to Alabama. We're from Texas, so I started interviewing around, looking around, and I'd always heard of BMC, and I was like, oh, I want to work for BMC. And then my recruiter called and said, have you heard of them? And it's like, yeah. And then she goes, well, they have would you be interested in taking a job in Austin? I was like, that's the company I want to work for, and that's the city I want to live in. It's like, absolutely.
Made up. Perfect.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, so I was very, very happy to join BMC.
And how many years have you been there now?
Just shy of 29.
Wow.
Wow.
That's
genuine. So by the time you joined BMC, did you know more than just minus stop DB2 and minus stop DB2?
No, that was all I knew. And then when I joined BMC, I did the install for the database administrator products. Right. So you'd go through the dialogues and it'd prompt what your table space names were, buffer pools and all. I had no idea what any of that stuff was. I just did what I was told to do.
Yeah.
And, I'd prompt for the stuff and I would build the appropriate scripts to build the objects. And then after about 2 years, the lead QA for change manager asked if I would want to join the team. And I was like, sure, that'd be great. So I joined the change manager team, and then slowly it's like, oh, this is why we would ask for buffer pool. That's what it's being used for. And slowly but surely, I started learning it. And then after a few years, I got onto the analysis engine. That's where, the way I put it, is it's a program that enforces the SQL reference manual.
Right.
In doing that is when I started learning DB2, learning the catalog very closely and things of that sort.
Quite a steep learning curve at that point then.
Yes, yes.
Cool. Wow.
So, <Yeah. clears throat> and where did that take you once you learned all of that and you gained that knowledge? Where did that take you in the path within BMC?
So I continued. I worked on Change Manager until about 2008. And at that point, I was offered the position of solution architect, which is, it is in essence the technical manager, the technical lead over, and again, it's the administrative products, which is right. Change manager, catalog manager, DASD, now command center. So it got me into that role. And the way I put it, most of the people I worked with, any of them could have taken the role. But, some of them weren't interested in things of that sort, and it was a good career move for me.
Yeah.
So I took it and been in that position now for, I guess, close to 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Sounds like quite a challenging role, though.
It can be. It's like a lot of what we try to do is, okay, I have the administrative products. We integrate fairly well. But in that role is, working with the other areas, ensuring that we're integrating well with the utilities and vice versa, things of that sort. Because, many times with Change Manager, one of the main goals is if we build a work list, it's going to run.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, the utilities will, oh, we support this feature. It's like, okay, that's great. And then we go through, it's like, oh, well, we don't support it if there's this and this. It's like, well, we need to know that. We need to know what those exceptions are.
Yeah.
And it just causes a lot of testing, but it's good.
Yeah.
And over time, the teams have gotten closer, so when things like that come up, we're not having to ask, they tell us.
That's good. That's good. And you've obviously lived through a lot of versions of DB2.
Yes.
And lots of changes, some fairly significant ones. From your perspective, what have you enjoyed seeing the most, and maybe what's been the biggest pain for you?
Well, what I remember just getting my feet wet on was when I joined Change Manager, DB2 version 5 came out and triggers came out.
Okay, yeah.
And when I started that release, I was doing the user interface. So I did all of the user interface work to support triggers.
Yeah.
And then they switched me to the analysis engine. So then they're like, well, you've already done all this. You understand it. You can do this in analysis. So that was a huge learn, because it was a brand new object, trying to understand it. You know, the concepts, you know, back then were a little foreign.
Yeah.
You know, so that was definitely probably my first really big challenge.
Right.
And I'd say the other things that through the years that I've just found really interesting is all of the new online schema changes that have been made available. It's like, you know, when we had the products, you know, almost 90% of the time, if you did something, we were going to do an unload, drop the data, rebuild it, and load it all back up. And now that's the exception.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of cool to see how that has transformed over time.
It's brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just more and more is coming, which is good to hear.
And it's the type of thing that also you still have to be aware of those exceptions.
Yes.
You know, because it's like, oh, yeah, you can do an online schema change. Oh, but if you have a view, you know, it's like, you know, those are things just to, you have to take into account.
Yeah. You recently did a podcast for BMC.
I did one about on DevOps.
DevOps.
Is that an internal podcast?
No, this is also on Spotify along with our podcast. But this was about DevOps and the importance of database administrators.
Yes, I mean, the main thing on that particular podcast was trying to show what the important, because we did customer surveys, and what we found is the majority of the times when a customer was doing a deployment and the deployment failed, the majority of the time it was because the source code and the schema changes that they were pushing out did not go out in sync. Yeah, one or the other didn't make it, and that is what caused the failures.
Right.
And that's why with database DevOps, it's a critical feature, because it allows you, you know, you define a DevOps pipeline to do your source code, push it up, but you can also drive your database changes at the same time.
Right.
You know, so you have a much better control if you run that pipeline, you know that your source is going to make it, and your schema changes are going to make it.
Yeah.
And if you don't, you have a mechanism to back it out as well, which is critical.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you can, I've known in my tenure as a DBA, you can get maverick DBAs who create an index here or create an index there, particularly in production if there's a performance issue. You know, pull
I've
the
never
key.
Done that, Mark.
Pull a key, log on, you know, raise a change, create this production index for performance, do the rebind quickly, bang, everything's as it should be. All is right with the world. Performance is better. And you think, oh, phew, great. I've saved a massive outage.
And then you forget about it.
And then you forget that you have to filter that index back down to all of the other environments. So that's where your DevOps
process, it kind of works both ways, because you doing a DevOps pipeline, you have to be able to propagate your changes from test to QA to production. But as you just described, once you have things in production, fine, you need to propagate that master copy all the way back down to all of your development copies, because they need to be working with the current version.
Mm. Yeah. And I was just, the great thing about IDEC is that you get to meet all sorts of interesting people, not just people like Frank or anyone else like that, but users, people who are at the coalface, using DB2, fixing problems, making a difference to their business. I was talking to someone yesterday and they were saying it's critical that DBA is involved in the development process because you've got developers now, they don't know jack about good database design.
Yeah.
You've got two tables, they're related, you've got to have a primary key. If there's a foreign key, you must have an index on the foreign key. Otherwise, performance goes out through the window. Stuff like that. Developers don't need to know that. So by shifting left and giving the developers the opportunity to create their own tables and whatnot, you're in danger of losing that good performance experience and knowledge.
That's one of the reasons why it's good to have, you know, there's a lot of tools out there, but like, you know, Change Manager, what I'm familiar with, to have a tool like that where it will check for things like that, where, you know, a DBA knows it.
Yeah.
The developer doesn't necessarily, but, you know, we before we ever try to roll anything out, we can say, hey, you're missing your index for this.
Yeah. The DBAs can set the rules and the process enforces them.
Yes. So the DBAs still have their control.
Yeah.
But the developers can, you know, do their changes whenever they want with the satisfaction of knowing that they won't break anything.
Yes. Yeah. Frank, you must have had the opportunity to travel quite a lot with your job.
Yes.
Any good stories from your travels? Any exciting places you've been?
My very first time over was in like 2005, and I went to Zurich.
Oh.
And I was so excited. It was like, you know, first time actually coming to Europe. I remember on the plane, my friend came with me, and I'm talking to him. I go, it really exists. They talked about it in our history books, but it really exists. You know? So that was the first trip. And then what I found kind of amusing, my subsequent two trips all went to Zurich. And I was just like, okay,
I've seen
this city. I want to see something different. But, you know, over time, I've visited Germany many, many times now.
Yeah.
Done some trips to Italy, the UK, you know, Benelux, all of those. But I'd say the most fun trips that I think I've had, mainly because my wife was able to join me on them, is to Australia.
Oh, amazing. Is that for iDucks?
Yes, I've gone to, I think it was 2012 and 2017, I went over there for that, and it was very, very nice.
Yeah.
The only drawback is iDuck tends to be in the fall or the early spring for them.
Right.
So it was just like, it was a little rainy, a little cold.
A bit cooler than you might have hoped.
Yeah, but it was. We had a really, really good time.
That's really good. And have you got any horror stories from your travels where things have gone wrong?
Last year.
COVID.
COVID.
Yes, I came over, did two customer visits, and then we arrived in Cologne because there was going to be a DB2 roundtable where we were going to talk with our customers. And when I got to the hotel, I was like, man, my throat feels scratchy. And I was like, I'm going to take a test just in case. And I was positive.
Oh.
So they literally blocked my door. And I was locked in the room for 10 days.
10 days? Oh, my God.
And everyone went home, like, about at day six.
And left you in Cologne.
And left me there. And it's like, finally, it was on the subsequent Sunday, the only reason they would let me out of my hotel room was to take an official COVID test at the pharmacy.
Right.
So on that Sunday afternoon, I was like going stir crazy. I had to get out of the hotel room.
Yeah.
So I scheduled a COVID test and I went and it came up negative. And I remember I was sitting at the train station because that's where the pharmacy was. And it's like a tear actually came to my eye. I get to go home.
The relief.
I get to go home.
Because you must have felt a bit like a prisoner. I mean, obviously you weren't, but it must
mainly
have felt
because
like that.
I was positive for 10 days, but I was only sick for two.
Right. So you felt okay in yourself, but because you were quarantining,
you just
couldn't leave.
One thing I learned is if you're quarantined and you're locked in your hotel room and you decide you're going to sneak out because you want to just take a walk by the river away from people, don't forget your hotel key in your room.
Oops.
I got a phone call from security from the hotel about that one.
Oh, that's funny.
So, if our listeners were to pop onto YouTube and type in Rhodes Family Christmas, what would they see?
Or Facebook. I follow Frank on Facebook.
Yeah. Okay. Or Facebook.
they would definitely see my Christmas light addiction. I always make the term when I would talk about it, it's like, yes, and I track every light bulb in DB2.
Tell us a bit about it.
The reason DB2 has got like insert after the end of a partition for and member cluster is because of Frank's Christmas light.
So I do a large display. I have a display. A good part of it is a static display, meaning like animals in a river scene and things of that sort. And then I also have an automated display, which is I have trees all wrapped with multiple colors of lights.
Yeah.
And then they will dance to the music.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
Over my driveway, I have a 40-foot arch over the driveway.
And your house is covered, isn't it?
The house is completely covered.
And is it the same inside as well?
Yes, my wife, I do the outside, my right. wife does the inside. And it's like, you know, she'll do the inside. We have a 12-foot Christmas tree. And
wow.
So we definitely go all out at Christmas time.
But you start this around Thanksgiving, don't you?
I will start on November 1, and then I always turn on Thanksgiving.
Right.
So I start on November 1, and then everyone knows in November, every Monday and Friday, Frank's on vacation.
Right.
Because I'll do that.
You need that time to set everything up.
Yeah, I end up taking like 2 weeks of vacation total in November,
yeah.
getting everything going and getting it all ready.
Yeah, and you've got a massive following, haven't you? People come from far and wide to see your display.
We have.
And don't your neighbours join in with going down the road as well? And
there's a couple of neighbours that will do some stuff. Then one of the things that I did for the neighbourhood, because they have to suffer through the traffic of people coming to see the house.
Yeah.
Is we have a fence line through our neighborhood that is, I don't know, about maybe half of a mile. And I have lights on both sides of the fence line.
Yeah,
so that when you're coming through a car, it looks like you're in a tunnel.
Oh, that's amazing.
It is a very cool effect.
That's really cool. And also, you raise money for charities, don't you?
Yeah, it's when I would do it, someone would come by, it's like, well, you know, here, you must be spending so much money on your electric bill. Here, let me donate to help you with that. It's like, no, I'm doing this because I want to do this.
And
now I'm like, well, if someone's willing to donate, maybe. So I started, it was funny, I called the local food bank, and I go, I'd like to be a collection site. Is that okay? And they're like, oh, sure. Is this a business? It's like, no, it's
not
a home.
Not exactly.
It's like, you know, I want to do it with my Christmas lights. She says, do you think you're actually going to collect food for people coming by to see your lights? It's like, I think so. So through the years now, I think we're well over 10,000 pounds of food that we've collected directly, and over $40,000 in cash that we've provided the food bank. So
that's incredible.
They're ecstatic with that.
Oh, yeah. Well done. I mean, that's
amazing.
An amazing achievement. Yeah, and great for your community as well.
Yeah, I enjoy it. And then I will, like, the week before Christmas, almost every night, I'm outside. I'm out there, you know, talking to the people coming by. I have a little stocking to collect donations for the food bank. My wife calls herself a Christmas widow because
she doesn't see me.
Oh,
that's fun.
But the children in your area must love it as well because
yes.
It must make it so magical for them.
I have to be honest. Putting up the lights, I cannot stand it most of the time.
Really?
It can, you know, it just gets tedious and all.
Oh.
But then I'm there and I'm doing it, and then it's like, oh, look, Mr. Frank put this up. And looking as I'm working it, the kids will be coming, you know, going in front of the house. It's like, okay,
that's
is why I
do it.
So how big must your loft be? Is it like bigger inside than the outside, or has it got like three stories?
I used to keep everything in the attic above my son's bedroom, and then it made me nervous that something was going to happen to my son. If something, so I ended
the ceiling would collapse.
Yes. So, I don't know. It's probably been a good 15 years now because I've been doing the light display for like 21 years now.
Wow.
So about for the last 15 years, we've rented a storage unit, which is a 10 by 10 storage unit where I built custom shelves, and that's where I put everything. Like, I have totes, you know, boxes, and each box has numbers on it. And then whenever I put lights in there, okay, this is for tree 7, it's in this tote, and this is for tree 18, this is in...
Do you have a database for this?
Yes, exactly. I do. I joked about DB2, but I do have to track that in database, just because when it's time to set up, when I first started all of this, I'd have the garage just covered with these totes. And I'd have to look through every one of them looking for what I was trying to find. And it's like, okay, I have to get more organized.
Yeah. BMC Amy Rio customers, your data is in safe hands.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
Yeah. Oh, I've seen the photos and the videos on YouTube, and I've shown them to a friend of mine back home. He's a church administrator, and he's inspired. So the car park and the roof, it's all completely bedecked from early December all the way through.
So Jim Kurtz, one of the software consultants at BMC, I got him addicted to this. And then now he does a huge display at his house and then at his church in his area.
Oh, brilliant. It's catching.
Yes.
A good thing to catch, though, isn't it?
Mm.
Much better than COVID.
Yeah. And to think that you raised so much to help the community is just
phenomenal.
What most people find amusing is many times, in July, is the National Christmas Light Convention. So I will...
The what now?
National Christmas Light Convention.
And July. Are you president of that?
No. Believe me, there's people far sicker than I am.
And where is this convention held?
It has been Chicago. It's been in Biloxi. It moves around the country. But you go to it and they offer sessions on... Because to do a lot of the controlling of the lights, you have... there's hardware controllers that you can use. You can use, Pi computers to drive some of this. It all depends on what you go into.
Right.
Today... Everything is like pixel controlled. I have a little bit of pixel controlled lights, but in the past, everything I had was just all white, all red, set colors like that. But now, using those pixel controls, that's where you end up using like the Pis to drive it, because you're having to send a lot of data down the line.
So, for people that don't really understand what you're talking about, what are you talking about with pixel?
So a Raspberry Pi is a $35 computer about the size of a credit card.
Yeah.
And they've just announced the Raspberry Pi 5. But any of them, it's Internet of Things, basically. So they're tiny little computers.
So just keeping a pixel is like literally like you'd see on the computer screen.
Yeah.
You get a light bulb and it is a pixel. And
so you can make it any color.
I can make it any of, I think it was 32,000 colors.
Okay.
And then you can control it so...
So you can make a picture out of your lights.
Yes.
You can change it and animate it.
Yes.
If you want.
Like I built a 6-foot Christmas tree with pixel lights on it. And and you'll see it'll look like snow is falling and it begins to collect on the bottom and things of that sort.
Oh, that's so cool.
I want to see
that. So you can get quite techie with your...
Oh, yes. Well, I always joke, I work for BMC. I work in, as a computer person. It is a place of nerds, and it's really bad when they view me as the nerd at the place of nerds.
You're a nerd's nerd.
Yeah. That's kind of like a badge of honor, though, isn't it? To be the king of nerds.
Definitely. So, does your electricity bill go up over the Christmas period?
How bad is it? It must do.
Before LED lights, which is light-emitting diode lights. Before, my electric bill would go up, it would make our November and December as if it was in the middle of summer running the air conditioner constantly.
Ah, okay.
But then after I went to the LED lights, that cut more than in half.
Right, okay.
It really, really made a difference. The big thing it did also is prior, I would do the lights and... there was many times I was maxing out all of my breakers. We have 20-amp breakers. Everything was maxed out. And there was times my wife would turn on the oven and boom, the lights in the house would go out. So once I went to the LED lights, that no longer became a problem.
Your system was stabilized.
Yes. It definitely, because normal light strings, incandescent strings, you know, they say never put more than three. I could get eight or nine strings together without it going out. With LED lights, I have 800-foot runs with one plug.
Wow. Yeah.
Just because they use so little power.
Right.
Yeah, impressive.
What's the future of Christmas lights then?
AI.
Yeah.
Oh, you could mimic people walking past.
Well, that's, some people go to the extent where, you know, I was talking about the pixel lights and you said you can do video and all that. Some people will literally cover their home with pixel boards.
Right.
And but at that point, it's not really a Christmas display. It's more like you're looking at a big TV.
Yeah.
You know, and they'll do stuff on there, but it's like, to me, as I said, I do like a static display.
Yeah.
I have like 20 deer. I have, you know, seals and penguins and things of that sort. I like all the animals, a lot of inflatables for the little kids.
Yeah.
That's what they enjoy seeing.
Yeah.
They don't get it when the lights are blinking.
It makes it more Christmassy.
Yeah.
More
traditional. Definitely, yeah. So you need to keep the balance of the traditional stuff plus this newfangled fancy stuff.
Yeah, fancy, geeky, nerdy tech stuff.
Yeah.
When I go to those Christmas conventions, that's what, the last time I went to the Christmas convention, I came home and I had a pixel tree. I was like, I've got to try this.
And I remember seeing you somewhere, and you, I think like everywhere you go around maybe this time of year, you try and pick something up to add to your display. And I think you may have had a bear or something that you were trying to get into your suitcase to take back to the States.
I did not know this.
Yes. I found a store in Turin, Italy, which has really, really nice display stuff. I can never find anything like that in the U.S.
Right.
So I started, like, some of the penguins I have, I got there. Some of the seals I got. And then a couple years ago, it might have been the one that you're referring to, there was this walrus. I loved it. It was so, except it was huge.
The size of your suitcase.
Bigger. Much bigger than my suitcase. I was like, maybe I can tell him it's my support animal on the plane. You know, it needs to sit next to me.
Yeah.
But
you got it back.
That was going to be too much of a...
too expensive.
Yeah, too much of an endeavor.
Literally another seat on the plane.
Yes. Yeah, that's the one that got away.
Right.
Though I am planning in this December, I am planning to go and I'm going to visit Turin again. So I have to make a stop at the store.
Right.
And they know me now that I'm the crazy American because I'll show them pictures of their stuff in my display.
Oh, I bet they love you though.
That's nice free marketing for them.
Yeah. Yeah, but I don't know how many people I get to go to their store from the U.S.
Yeah, that's true.
But I'm sure it's not just people in the U.S. that are looking at the videos and Facebook, so you never know.
So Christmas occupies most of your July,
and then
November, December. And then how long does it take you to take it all down?
Normally I'm able to get it down and 2 or 3 good weekends.
Okay.
You know, and that's always my goal. And my wife sets the goal. It's like February 1, it's gone.
Right.
So that's a couple of months of the year. And I suppose the rest of the year, you're busy working hard to save money for the next Christmas. Is there anything else that you do?
No, for the most part, I will do that. When I go in July to the conferences, that's where I'll get ideas.
Mm.
And then what I will then end up doing is, like, when I start my display, I've got to do everything for my display to get it the way it was. And then after I'm done with that, okay, let me play with these new things that that I learned and try this, that, or the other. So I will put things out into my display. I turn on Thanksgiving, but it could be, especially because I take off like the 2 weeks of Christmas. So a lot of times in those 2 weeks, I'll build something new and put it out.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. Very inventive.
Very cool. Yeah. Quite unique as well. Well, apparently not, because there's a whole
culture of...
Yeah,
of
a user group.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, pretty unique, I guess, for the majority of us. We probably don't know many people that go to that extreme.
International Christmas User Group, iChug.
Well, at the one, we actually, We had a couple people from Australia show up, and there were some people from England that went to one of them. I think they just happened to be in the U.S., so they went ahead and synced it up with that. But
that's pretty cool.
I went on AS400 course, iSeries, in the early 2000s, and it was around about Christmas time, and the instructor had said that he'd just bought a new house somewhere near Swindon in England, and as Christmas was approaching, the neighbours all gathered together and knocked on his door, and they said, sorry, but we don't want to, you know, upset you or put you off or anything, but in this street we're all sort of very popular about getting Christmas lights up.
Right.
Is that something that would offend you or something that you would be willing to consider? And this guy's eyes lit up, and he just showed them photos of the houses that he'd had in the past that completely bedecked with Christmas lights, and he was very welcomed into the new community.
Yeah, there's a cul-de-sac down about a mile from where I live, and it's kind of... They have the Night Before Christmas poem written on huge plywood sheets, painted really nice. And you go through, and each home, all the homes are decorated. And you can just slowly go through and read the poem and go all the way through. And a lot of times they'll come by my house, or I'll send people to their house. And it's like, both is like, they're like, God, we wish you lived in our area. And I'm like, I wish my neighbors would get into this the way, because... I always think when you have multiple homes doing displays like that, it looks that much nicer. It really does.
Quite an impact, yeah. Well, you've still got time to work on them.
I've got this quote from Star Trek going through my mind, where Dr. Beverly Crusher is on her own on the Starship Enterprise, and she says, "Well, there's nothing wrong with me, so there must be something wrong with the universe."
There you go.
There's nothing wrong with all of you. There's just something wrong with everybody else. But I'm really, really glad that we had the opportunity to speak to you.
And I feel quite Christmassy now.
Yeah. I mean, what is it, November? It's October. November's coming up soon. GSE in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then Christmas will be upon us.
It will be. So start saving up
and getting those LEDs out.
Yeah. But I'll be following Frank for the real Christmas feel. But thank you, Frank, for talking to us. And it's really nice to see you in person. Yeah.
Thank you all very much for having me.
Visit idug.org for the latest DB2 community news, information about events, and all of our technical content. Tune in again soon for the next podcast at idug.org/podcast.